recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, starting 10 minutes late because my computer is so slow that I can't stand it anymore. And I've been offline for 5 days because I've been traveling and been so busy I haven't had a chance to even get online the last couple of days. And for some reason, it's taking my computer forever to respond. Anyway, so how are you doing tonight, Bill?
Wonderful. Praise Yahweh.
Good, good. Tonight, we're going to start our series on Ezekiel. And I'm going to follow the pattern we've been having here. I'm going to be quoting from the introduction in my King James version of the Bible. And because it's always very orthodox and very Judeo-Christian, antinomian, and dispensationalist, just to get their perspective right off the bat. But before I do that, do you have any introductory comments before I quote from these people?
Well, no, I'll follow those people.
Okay. All right. So this is from my King James Version, which is called the Word of God. It's a big type for older people like me, and lots of commentaries and cross-references and articles in the front of the Bible and the back of the Bible. It's all very dispensationalist. It's nauseatingly so, but it gives you the perspective of the Judeo-Christian churches today. It really does. Okay, so here is the survey for the book of Ezekiel, and the author says, the book of Ezekiel records the activity of a prophet during the exile in Babylonia. His message was directed to his fellow captives and also to the Hebrew people still at home in Palestine. Both groups remained obstinate and impenitent even after the capture of Jerusalem by the Babylonian king, Nebuchadrezzar. Okay, this might be a misprint here.
Yeah, that Nebuchadrezzar is basically a variation on
it's okay, it's the same person.
Yes.
Okay. And the exiling of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, together with a large segment of the population in 597 B.C. God therefore assigned to Ezekiel the task of denouncing the rebellious house of Israel and of foretelling the destruction of Jerusalem and the deportation of still greater numbers. 6 years after Ezekiel had begun to preach, his words came true. In 586 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem and brought all but a few of the survivors to Babylonia. But Israel's unfaithfulness did not exhaust God's mercy. Ezekiel was also directed to proclaim the good news that the exile would end and that Israel would be restored to her position as the instrument of God's salvation to all men. Of course, by all men, they mean all races, colors, and what have you. So regarding this first paragraph here, is this fairly accurate that the book of Ezekiel is addressed to the entire house of Israel, all Israel, even though he is of Judah?
Yes, it is definitely. It's explicitly stated in Ezekiel, in the opening chapters of Ezekiel, that Yahweh was sending him to the captivity of Israel.
Uh-huh.
And Ezekiel is in a place where we will see where Israel was taken captive and one of the places where they were deposited by the Assyrians.
Right. Okay, so the Assyrian captivity started around 745 B.C. and continued, I think in Isaiah, wasn't it 75 years that Isaiah said that this process of captivity by various Assyrian kings took place?
Right, it was 65 years, 365 years.
Okay.
And that ended probably, even though the last of the deportations of the Israelites are not recorded.
Okay.
They're not recorded. And
right.
And who would have been there to record them?
Right.
It's evident from the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. Ezra much later on, that Esarhaddon was the last of the Assyrian kings to have any activity concerning population movements in the land of Israel. And that ran up to about 676 B.C.
Okay, so when did the Babylonians take over this territory, which would be the northern end of Mesopotamia?
Well, the Scythians actually came to hegemony in by the middle of the by about 640 B.C., but they didn't maintain it. they had hegemony over all Asia, as Herodotus attests, for 26 years, I believe.
Okay.
During those 26 years, Nineveh was destroyed.
Right.
Now, the Scythians withdrew. They did not stay. And this is the Greek version of events several hundred years after they happened.
Okay.
Okay. I believe that those Scythians that had hegemony were the Cimmerians who then crossed Anatolia and passed into Europe.
Right.
And that a branch of them had assisted the Medes and Babylonians in destroying Nineveh and the cities of the Assyrians.
Right.
Now the last cities of the Assyrians fell, I believe, about 612 BC, after which the Babylonians gained the hegemony, being the most powerful of the remaining nations of the time, the Persians, the Medes, any Scythians that were left that didn't withdraw. Now the Scythians, I believe those Scythians were a segment of the children of Israel.
Right.
I have no doubt about that. Who withdrew from the area.
Okay.
Who went on to greener pastures, more or less.
Yeah.
Now, Ezekiel, all right, Daniel was taken a political hostage to Babylon. All right? So did, and the 2 Kings chapter 24 explains this. Now, this is the same practice that the Romans later had, to bring people from subject nations back to their own capital so that those people can learn the culture of the dominating nation.
Mm-hmm.
The Romans did the same thing. They took political hostages from every country they conquered. They brought them back. It served two purposes. First, so that a population of the ruling class of the subject nation could learn the conquering nation's ways and customs and language.
Mm-hmm.
And second, because with a good portion of the princes of your nobles away at this foreign capital, you're more likely to be a good subject nation.
Right. Right.
If all of your leading men have their sons or their brothers off at this foreign capital.
Yeah, and then when they come back, they'll be agents of the occupying power anyhow.
well, right. That was Daniel's situation.
Okay.
All right. And that happened circa 605 BC in the third year of Jehoiakim. Now, Jehoiakim or Jehoiakim or however you want to pronounce that, he was replaced with Jehoiachin or Jehoiachin. And that happened circa 597 BC by the Babylonians, who then took Jehoiakim into captivity with 10,000 of the chief men and the craftsmen of Judea, of Judah.
Okay.
Now, those 10,000, 597 BC, Ezekiel was among them.
Okay.
Now, much of Ezekiel's early prophecy actually parallels things that Jeremiah said. And they were contemporaries.
Right.
But Jeremiah started prophesying a lot earlier, around 627 BC.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Ezekiel doesn't start prophesying until the fifth year of his captivity.
Right.
And that's probably around 592 BC when Ezekiel starts. Now, Ezekiel prophesies for 22 years.
Okay.
And he times that. Now there's evidence, and I'm going off on a tangent, I know.
No.
There's evidence that the book of Ezekiel, it's clear to me that chapters may be out of place.
Okay.
Just like we saw chapters out of place in Daniel.
Right.
All right? Because in Ezekiel 1, he states that he's writing in the fifth year of captivity. In Ezekiel 29, he states that it's the 27th year of captivity.
Uh-huh.
In Ezekiel chapter 40, it's the 25th year of captivity.
Mm-hmm.
So either there's a scribal error somewhere, or the chapters are out of order.
Right.
Which we've seen clearly happen with Daniel, and which someday we'll see. If you compare the Septuagint and the King James, Jeremiah is okay with the Septuagint and the Masoretic text up until after chapter 24. And after chapter 24, when you compare the Septuagint and the Masoretic text, it seems like one of those books was shuffled like a deck of cards.
Yeah.
It's the Masoretic text. It's like somebody took the remaining scrolls and mixed them all up and put them in some random kind of order.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, and we saw that actually in Genesis with the flow of the patriarchs interrupted by stories about the Edomites and, you know, et cetera, thrown in where they really shouldn't belong. You know, they should be added separately, possibly at the end, but there's all kinds of interruptions, yeah.
Yeah, right. Scribes collated these books in, over time, and sometimes they didn't do the best job.
Right.
Because these books were actually, you know, Jeremiah may have been a whole collection of scrolls with one or two or three chapters on a scroll.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And when they get mixed up and some scribe tries putting them back together again, and it's kind of like Humpty Dumpty, right?
Yeah.
But let me say that Ezekiel started prophesying the fifth year of the captivity, 592 BC. That's right in the middle of Hezekiah's reign in Judah.
Okay.
He's the last king of Judah.
Okay.
And about 6 or 7 years after Ezekiel begins the prophecy, there's no more Jerusalem.
Right.
But we'll see in these opening chapters that Ezekiel's message is to the Israelites who were placed in Habor by the Assyrians.
Right.
Now, we read that the Israelites were placed in several places by the Assyrians. And one of the places is the land of Habor. Okay? Now, here, that is called Kibar.
Right.
Now, there is a modern river called Kibar, but I think that the modern river got its name from the land, because here Ezekiel sent to the river of Kibar.
Right.
And that's, you know, and that was the river Gozan in Kings, the river the land of Habor by the river Gozan is where some of the Israelites were deposited.
Okay. Right.
And these are the people that Ezekiel is told to direct his message to.
Okay, so it sounds like these 10,000 among whom Ezekiel was one were deposited among a previous house of Israel. So
we don't know if Ezekiel, if the 10,000 were deposited there or not, but Ezekiel was sent there.
Okay. But he's definitely, it seems that he is among the captives of the house of Israel.
Right. But the 10,000 may have been spread out.
Right.
I doubt if they were kept all together.
Yes. Yeah. And if this is the case, we sort of assume that under Sennacherib, the captives taken by the Assyrian king Sennacherib were added to the house of Israel, so that we have basically all 12 tribes represented in the dispersion, okay? And so Ezekiel apparently is prophesying to the entire dispersion, not just to either the house of Israel or the house of Judah.
Right, absolutely.
Okay, all right.
Now, I'll have comments on this Kibar and Habor as we
get into it. Okay.
As we get into the book. But let me say this, that the Jews, you know, there's a lot of skeptics, and they like to say that Ezekiel really wasn't by Kibar, which is a different word. It is a slightly different word. It could very well be a transliteration of the same word in a different dialect.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same word, Kibar.
Okay.
Habor,
right.
Kibar, same word. It's a different Strong's number, of course. But I think that the reasons for that are due to dialect.
Right.
Kibar is 3529 and Habor is 2249.
Mm-hmm.
Now the Jews love to say that Ezekiel couldn't be sent to that same place, that Kibar can't be the same place, that Kibar has to be a canal that the captives were digging, that they invent a history, right?
Right.
In Babylon, which is a pure contrivance.
Mm-hmm.
What the Jews attempt to do is to conceal the fact that these Israelites were in large numbers in northern Syria.
Right, right.
And that's where they were.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Joseph says, there's a great multitude of Israelites beyond the Euphrates.
Right.
Well, the river Kibar actually empties into the Euphrates from the north.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it is beyond the Euphrates.
Right, right. And and Josephus says that they are not captive to the Romans as the Judahites and Benjamin. So he perfectly understands that the other 10 tribes are still in existence and are an immense multitude. Yes. Okay. Let's continue here with the survey. The manner in which the book of Ezekiel presents this message of judgment and promise distinguishes it from other prophetic books of the Old Testament. Its first unique feature is the systematic arrangement of the contents. Well, we find out it's interrupted. The first 24 chapters set forth Israel's arraignment and condemnation with terrifying consistency. This prospect of doom, relieved by only incidental rays of light, is balanced in the last section, chapters 33 through 48, by an equally consistent portrayal of the bright future that God has in store for his people. I guess in contrast to the book of Isaiah, the doom and gloom was interspersed with rays of hope fairly consistently. So they're saying here all the doom and gloom is arranged in the front and all of the rays of hope are arranged at the end.
Well, let's say, they're harping on that, the new temple, the measurement of the new temple.
Right, right, which corresponds, of course, with the book of Revelation. Continuing here, dividing these solid blocks of threat and promise to Israel, there is a series of addresses to foreign nations which have a double aspect. They pronounce doom upon the wicked neighbors of Israel, but the destruction of Israel and Israel's enemies also constitutes an assurance that they will not be able to hinder the fulfillment of God's promise to redeem and restore his chosen people. I like this. But, of course, when they get to the New Testament, they redefine who the chosen people are. Continuing, another unique feature of the book of Ezekiel is the form in which both threat and promise are expressed. It abounds in mysterious visions, daring allegories, and weird symbolic actions. Yes, there's a lot of weird stuff. These media of God's revelation occur here more frequently than in any other prophetic book and are presented with an equally unusual elaboration of descriptive detail. The visions, in particular, are bizarre, almost grotesque in form, and we'll find that out in chapter 1 right away, and therefore difficult to interpret. But the basic meaning of the book of Ezekiel will not elude the reader if he keeps in mind that God's glory and his great acts of judgment and salvation are portrayed in symbolic language and form. What Ezekiel sees in visions, describes in allegories, and acts out in a manner resembling charades is designed to contribute to the assurance that God is carrying forward his plan of salvation for all men, replace that with Israel, that he initiated in his covenant with Israel centuries ago, purified by God's judgment in the Babylonian exile. Israel will again become the bearer of the promises to be fulfilled in the new covenant, and to the end of time. That's very good. All of this Ezekiel sees in prophetic perspective, in which scenes of the immediate and of the distant future are at times superimposed on the same picture of the coming and enduring kingdom of God. Okay, so let's get into it. That was actually a pretty good survey, except for a couple of instances where he wanted to insert all men in place of Israel. Okay, Ezekiel. Chapter 1, verse 1. Now it came to pass in the 30th year, in the fourth month, in the fifth day of the month, as I was among the captives by the river Chebar, okay, and this is spelled Chebar, that the heavens were opened and I saw visions of God. Okay, do you want to?
Well, that's Zal. The CH is very commonly replaced with an H in
right.
Hebrew.
Yeah,
all right,
it's the guttural.
If you look at the Hebrew for Heth or the Hittites, it's Keth and Kittites.
Right.
That now it's Chobar in the Septuagint, Chobar.
Okay.
And that's very close. It's very close etymologically to Habor. It's the same word.
Right. Right.
Now the 30th year. That's the most likely the 30th year of Ezekiel's life.
Okay. Okay. Very good. Okay. Verse 2. In the fifth day of the month, which was the fifth year of King Jehoiakim's captivity.
Or 592 B.C.
Okay. The word of Yahweh came expressly to Ezekiel the priest, the son of Buzi, B-U-Z-I, in the land of the Chaldeans by the river Chebar. And the hand of Yahweh was there upon him.
Now let me say that this isn't necessarily the Chaldeans in Babylonia.
Okay.
Okay. The land of the Chaldeans. First, the Chaldeans were originally a tribe of Syrians,
mm-hmm.
of Aram, that had, around the time of Abraham, taken Babylonia for themselves.
Right.
They invaded Babylonia and took it from the former Hamite rulers, which were descended from Nimrod. The first Babylonian empire was Nimrod's empire.
Mm-hmm.
Now the land of the Chaldeans, from a Judean aspect, would have been all that land that they had held.
Yes.
So since they held Assyria, they held northern Syria, that they held a great, you know, we're not restricted to Babylonia here,
right,
when we think about the land of the Chaldeans.
Yeah.
Now this land, the Kibar flows from the north, from modern-day Turkey into the Euphrates in northern Syria,
mm-hmm,
in modern-day northern Syria. And that's actually the land of Padan Aram of Abraham's time.
Mm-hmm. Our old stomping grounds, yes. The Shemitic territory, yes. Okay. All right, verse 4. And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud, and a fire unfolding itself, and the brightness was about it, and out of the midst thereof was the color of amber out of the midst of the fire. Now remember, this is a vision, folks. This is not to be taken literally. Also, out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and everyone had four faces, and everyone had four wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Any comments on the symbolism so far here, Bill?
Well, this is the cherubic symbolism that we see in both ancient Israel and in Assyria.
Okay.
The winged bull with the head of a man was very common. That's a cherub.
Mm-hmm.
That is called a cherub in the inscriptions.
Right.
And a cherub is basically, and there have been many examples of them found, and over the years they were watered down and morphed, and sometimes they'll have just the body of a lion. Sometimes they'll have wings. Sometimes they won't. Sometimes they'll have the head of a lion with the wings and the feet of a bull. There's all different artistic variations that came later.
Right.
But I believe that the original cherub had to have these four symbols.
Mm-hmm.
The head of a man, the wings of an eagle, and the fore part of a lion and the hind part of a bull.
Okay.
And they are the four animals. The same animal composite found represents a composite of the four symbols of the banners of the four principal tribes of Israel,
right,
around the tabernacle and a unit in the wilderness. And we see the same symbolism in the book of Revelation,
mm-hmm,
depicting the throne of Yahweh.
Right.
It has the same four symbols, and they're Israel symbols.
Right, right. And we find this type of vision actually occurs first in the Garden of Eden, right after Adam and Eve are kicked out.
Well, the cherub that guards the gate,
right,
the entrance to the Garden of Eden.
Right, so that the DNA of the Adamic race cannot be tampered with by anybody. Right. Okay, so let's continue. And everyone had four faces, and everyone had four wings, and their feet were straight feet, and the sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass, and they had the hands of a man under their wings on their four sides, and they four had their faces and their wings. Their wings were joined to one another. They turned not when they went, and they went everyone straight forward. And as for the likeness of their faces, they had four, the face of a man, face of a lion, face of an ox, and the face of an eagle. Okay, man is Reuben, lion is Judah, ox is Ephraim, and eagle is Dan.
Right.
Okay. Verse 11. Thus were their faces, and their wings were stretched upward. Two wings of every one were joined one to another, and two covered their bodies. And they went every one straight forward. Where their spirit was to go, they went, and they turned not when they went. As for the likeness of the living creatures, and these are living creatures, they're not spaceships. we're not going to quote Van Daneken here today, I don't think. Okay. As for the likeness of the living creatures, their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps, it went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. And the living creatures ran and returned as the appearance of a flash of lightning. So he's seeing all this activity happening in the spirit world. Verse 15. Now as I beheld the living creatures, behold, one wheel upon the earth by the living creatures with its four faces. The appearance of the wheels and their work was like to the color of beryl, and they they four had one likeness, and their appearance and their work was, as it were, a wheel in the middle of a wheel. So he's seeing vortices of energy, force fields. Verse 17, when they went upon their four sides, and they turned not when they went. So they moved in unison. As for their rings, they were so high that they were dreadful, and their rings were full of eyes round about them, four. And when the living creatures went, the wheels went by them, and when the living creatures were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up. Verse 20, wherever the spirit was to go, they went. There was their spirit to go, and the wheels were lifted up opposite them, for the spirit of the living creatures was in the wheels. Any comment on these?
Well, yeah, I do. I think that Ezekiel is using the phrase living creature here to describe something that appeared to him to be animated,
mm-hmm.
but which they really didn't have a word for, right?
Mm-hmm.
The word is che, living creature,
yeah.
you know, but I think he's using it in the sense of animated. And I believe that he's using the word spirit here in the sense of apparition.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, to describe the entity that he's viewing. It's some sort of apparition. And it's the same way the Greeks use the word spirit very often in their writing to describe an apparition.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they would use pneuma, and sometimes they would use phantasma.
Right.
But it's still basically, and there's a couple of times in the New Testament where the word spirit is used in that same manner.
Right, right. Okay, either that or he had some fantastic drug.
well, right, I wasn't going to get into this until the end of the chapter.
Oh, okay.
I want to quote Job 26:9.
All right.
He holds back the face of his throne and spreads his cloud upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that indicates something very close to what Ezekiel is drawing a picture of here. And this chapter always, or at least very often, initiates discussions concerning UFOs.
Right.
And I think it has to be mentioned, right?
Yeah.
And while there's definitely more to the creation of Yahweh than meets the eye, which is attested to by Scripture, I believe there are some things that we can only conjecture.
Sure.
And I believe that at least most of the modern claims concerning UFOs are satanic.
Mm-hmm.
Because they always seem to try to spread the satanic World Brotherhood of Man agenda.
Right.
They always do.
Or scare us into accepting it. Right?
Well, right. And every one of those modern neo-freak UFO chasers
mm-hmm.
has this World Brotherhood of Man agenda
right.
that he's trying to use his UFO-claimed experiences to cram down our throats.
Right.
And I have to reject all of that as satanic. And I believe that we as Christians, well, we should be confident with what we know and comfortable with what we do not know.
Right. Verse 59, there were little grays that fell out of the vehicle.
Well, right, and told us that we should all love
right.
one another and don't marry black people.
But we must hate the Palestinians, right? Okay, verse 21. When those went, these went, and when those stood, these stood. So he's seeing a kind of a kaleidoscopic picture here of things moving in unison, in an orderly fashion. And when these were lifted up from the earth, the wheels were lifted up opposite them, for the spirit of the living creature was in the wheels. And the likeness of the firmament, okay, and I didn't have a chance to see where this word firmament is translated from. Well,
it's rakia, meaning an extended surface, a solid expanse.
Expanse, yes. Okay, so firmament is
7549 is the Strong's number.
Okay, but this concept of firmament is more of a Greek idea than a Hebrew idea, because the expanse is rakia, and that's from the Hebrew.
Well, that's the word that I'm trying to
right, and it doesn't convey the flat screen that the Greeks believed in. It conveys a sense of openness, you know. It conveys a sense of outer space, actually. And the likeness of the firmament upon the heads of the living creature was as the color of the terrible crystal stretched forth over their heads above. And under the firmament were their wings straight, the one toward the other. Every one had two which covered on this side, and every one had two which covered on that side their bodies. Now, this is all very reminiscent of the visions in the book of Revelation, regarding the thrones of heaven and the various angels and angelic beings, what have you, coming and going from heaven. Verse 24, and when they went, I heard the noise of their wings like the noise of great waters, as the voice of the Almighty, the voice of speech, as the noise of a host. When they stood, they let down their wings, okay, like an army. And there was a voice from the firmament that was over their heads when they stood and had let down their wings. And above the firmament that was over their heads was the likeness of a throne, as the appearance of sapphire stone. And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness of the appearance of the man above it. And I saw as the color of amber, as the appearance of fire round about inside it, from the appearance of his loins even upward, and from the appearance of his loins downward, I saw as it were the appearance of fire, and it had the brightness round about it. As the appearance of the bow that is in the cloud in the day of rain, so was the appearance of the brightness round about. This was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of Yahweh. And when I saw it, I fell on my face, and I heard a voice of one that spoke. In other words, he was awestruck and transfixed.
and all of that is very reminiscent of the Son of Man statements in John, where he saw the likeness of one that looked like the Son of Man, and he
right.
was this burnished brass and shone like
right.
the sun and
yeah.
all of that stuff.
So that the throne of Yahweh is a very colorful, magnificent place. Okay. All right. So that's kind of the introduction to the book of Ezekiel, chapter 2. And he said to me, Son of Man. He's speaking to Ezekiel. Ezekiel is a son of man, son of Adam. Stand upon your feet, and I will speak to you. And the Spirit entered into me when he spoke to me and set me upon my feet, that I heard him that spoke to me, and he said to me, Son of man, I sent you to the children of Israel, not to the world, folks, to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me even to this very day, for they are impudent children and stiff-hearted. I do send you to them, and you shall say to them, Thus says Yahweh Elohim. And they, whether they will hear it, or whether they like it or not, or whether they will forbear, for they are a rebellious house, yet shall know that there has been a prophet among them. And you, son of man, be not afraid of them, neither be afraid of their words through briars and thorns be with, though briars and thorns be with you.
And he's talking about people, right? The
right.
briars, the thorns,
exactly.
against their people.
Yes, yes.
And there are people in the New Testament, too.
That's right. That's right. And you do dwell among scorpions. They will stab you. They will trick you with poison. Be not afraid of their words, nor be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. And you shall speak my words to them, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, for they are most rebellious. But you, son of man, hear what I say to you. Be not you rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat that I give you. Okay? And there's the word eat being used in a very metaphorical sense.
Now Ezekiel was taken captive with 10,000 men of Judah.
Mm-hmm.
He's not being sent to them.
Right.
He's being sent to the prior dispersion, the prior captivity
huh.
of the children of Israel.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's, note that Ezekiel, all right. It can be determined that a great portion of these had already departed from the main body of the captives.
Yes.
And that was in fulfillment. That was the Cimmerians, and that was in fulfillment of the earlier prophecies of Isaiah.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, I think it was Isaiah 66:19 or 66:15, one or the other, that talked about the dispersion being sent to Lud and Javan. And we traced that in history and saw that was fulfilled a short time after Isaiah wrote it,
right.
within 150 years after Isaiah wrote it, or even sooner. Now here, that there is still a lot of Saka. Yeah, you know, Saka,
yeah.
the Saka were very dominant in eastern Anatolia at the time of the Greek writers.
Mm-hmm.
There were many that Saka, Sagalassus and Sakasane. Where
yes.
Sagalassus was a city in eastern Anatolia, described by Strabo and other Greek historians. It was a very big city of the Saka in eastern Anatolia, not far from this Kibar River.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes.
And Sakasane was even a little further east of that and in what we would know as modern-day Armenia, and that was talked about as a very fruitful, fertile area, and probably, and it was named Sakasene for the Saka. And those people, that's why the Jews would hate to correctly identify these people that Ezekiel's going to.
Because they're descendants of Isaac. Exactly.
Well right. I don't know how you could get around identity, this history, and identity has, Christian Israel identity has the only true interpretation of this history.
That's right.
And it's so clear when we compare the classical records with what's being spoken in the prophets.
Right. And as you mentioned when we were discussing the introductory comments from this KGV version here, that the Jews do whatever they possibly can to distort the true history of the lost tribes. Okay.
Right, and this is it. I mean, Ezekiel's going to these people in northern Syria, and we don't find large numbers of Jews there secular history.
There aren't any Jews at all. There aren't any Jews in Judah either.
Josephus himself in the first century tells us that there's large numbers of Israelites there, and the Greek classics scream Scythians.
Right. That's right. The Sakae, the Scythians, the Israelites, they're all the same people by different names. That's what they are. Okay, very good. Verse 9. And when I looked, behold, a hand was sent to me, and lo, a roll of a book was therein. And he spread it before me, and it was written inside and outside. And there was written therein lamentations and mourning and woe. Again, very similar to the book of Revelation. Chapter 3, verse 1. Moreover, he said to me, son of man, eat what you find. Eat this roll and go speak to the house of Israel. So I opened my mouth, and he caused me to eat that roll. And he said to me, son of man, cause your belly to eat and fill your bowels with this roll that I'm going to fill you with all this knowledge. Then did I eat it. And it was in my mouth as honey for sweetness. And he said to me.
Well, let me say that this is exactly like the same account we see is in Revelation chapter 10.
Right.
Verses 9 and 10.
Yeah, it tasted sweet, but in the belly it was bitter.
Right. And that's even what the scroll said and how it was treated and what it contained is very much like the corresponding account. In the Revelation at a much later time.
Yes, very good.
And it was sweet in his mouth and bitter in his belly.
Verse 4, and he said to me, son of man, go get you to the house of Israel and speak with my words to them. For you are not sent to a people of a strange speech and of a hard language, but to the house of Israel. Okay, well, they still knew Hebrew or version.
Well this is stressing that he wasn't going to the 10,000 fellow captives of Judah.
Right.
Yeah, you know, this is, well, if he was going to the 10,000 fellow captives of Judah, then why would all this be necessary?
Right.
Yeah, you know, these people don't talk funny.
Right.
They're basically, you know, the same people you are.
Yeah, they're only 100 years removed in their captivity, so that they were probably still speaking a lot of Hebrew.
Well, yes, but I think that when we see that this is stressed, It makes the Jewish interpretation of Ezekiel fall apart very easily.
Yes, because they're not to a different people from you. They are your kinsmen, right?
Well, not only that, but that he's not going to just simply Judah. That the Israelites of the captivity didn't disappear.
Right, right. And it says the house of Israel, which can only be the 10 tribes and whatever other Judahites would have been added to them. Okay, verse 6. Not to many people of a strange speech and of a hard language, whose words you cannot understand. Surely, had I sent you to them, they would have hearkened to you.
In other words, the strangers would listen.
Right.
Like the men of Nineveh actually listened to Jonah.
Yes, exactly. Verse 7. But the house of Israel will not hearken to you, for they will not hearken to me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. Behold, I have made your face strong against their faces and your forehead strong against their foreheads. Even if they didn't listen then, we're listening now, aren't we?
well, right. Where's Russell Walker when you need him? I mean, he should be listening to this.
Right.
Because here we have a man of Judah going to the impudent, hard-hearted house of Israel.
Exactly. They're good people. Verse 9. As an adamant, harder than flint have I made your forehead. Fear them not, Neither be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. You got to have a thick skin, in other words. Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, all my words that I shall speak to you receive in your heart and hear with your ears, and go, get you to them of the captivity, to the children of your people, and speak to them and tell them, Thus says Yahweh Elohim, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear or they will not hear. Okay, so here is a man, the son of man, son of Adam, of the house of Judah, telling the house of Israel what's what. 12. Then the Spirit took me up, and I heard behind me a voice of great rushing, saying, Blessed be the glory of Yahweh from his place. I heard also the noise of the wings of the living creatures that touched one another, and the noise of the wheels over against them, and a noise of a great rushing. So the Spirit lifted me up and took me away, and I went in bitterness, in the heat of my spirit, but the hand of Yahweh was strong upon me. And now it's interesting. Just about every single prophet in the Old Testament, in fact, no, there isn't any exception. Every single prophet in the Old Testament has nothing but words of condemnation for this rebellious house. Right? It's just a constant theme. Every single prophet.
But the promise of deliverance is always there.
Right, right. It's always there. But there's never any indication that these Israelites are a sinless people. There's never any indication of this until the restoration. Okay? So, verse 15.
I have an alternate reading of verse 15 from the Septuagint.
Oh, okay.
But let me just say that here, I'll let you read, you know, from here first, but let me just say that the Spirit took him up, and that's what we also see happen to Philip in Acts 8,
mm-hmm.
verses 39 and 40.
Right.
And the language definitely insists that that was a, you know, an extrasensory event.
Right.
It was a, I'm sorry.
Levitation?
I'm gonna pause
the Lord.
Levitation? No, but an event that's beyond our ability,
right.
naturally.
Right. Yeah, it's still a spiritual or, you know, a supernatural experience, however
supernatural.
You want to call it.
I couldn't come up with that word.
Right, right. And, you know, it's not to be taken literally, although it could be, you know, but it's metaphorical language, yes. But the hand of Yahweh was strong upon me. Then I came to them of the captivity at Tel Abib. Wow, Tel Abib.
Well, that's the, that dwelt by the river of Kibar, and that's
right.
Habor. Now, let me read the Septuagint there.
Okay.
Then I passed through the air and came into the captivity.
Mm-hmm.
Tel Abib is not there. That's
right.
What the Septuagint says. And that's basically what the Greek says. Then
right.
I passed through the air and came, in other words, the Spirit lifted him up.
Right.
And came up and he passed through the air and came into the captivity is what we read in the Septuagint.
Now, why do they have Tel Abib, you know, which implies Tel Aviv?
Well, right. It has to be that Tel Abib actually means hill of barley.
Right.
It has to be that the Septuagint translators had a different version of the Hebrew to work from, because you cannot get "then I passed through the air" from "then I came to them of the captivity at Tel Aviv."
Okay, well, obviously the King James is the Hebrew of the King James comes from the Masoretic text.
Well, yes, and it had to have a serious variation in it from the time
Right, right. Because the Jews want to reestablish themselves in Tel Aviv, right?
Right. That seems to be, right?
Right.
Then I passed through the air and came into the captivity. That's
right. But Tel Aviv is not by the river Kibar. It's near the Mediterranean Sea.
Right.
And the
Septuagint reading insists on a supernatural interpretation of the verse that precedes.
Right, right. Okay. And I sat where they sat and remained there astonished among them 7 days.
And astonished maybe at how he got there.
Yeah, right. Where am I? And it came to pass at the end of 7 days that the word of Yahweh came to me saying, Son of man, I have made you a watchman to the house of Israel. Therefore, hear the word at my mouth and give them warning from me. Underline that word watchman, folks, because there aren't any Judeo-Christians that are watchmen, not these days, folks. Verse 18, when I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him not warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, The same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood will I require at your hand.
So that's the responsibility of one who presumes to talk for Yahweh, right?
Right. So you better speak the truth, and you better give the warning when the warning is due, right? Because in the ancient of days, didn't these towns and villages, these walled villages, didn't they have like a tower? And in the tower was a watchman. He kept his eyes to see if there were enemy troops coming.
Well, right, and that's the whole symbology of the watchman.
Yeah.
To warn when danger is coming.
That's right.
And if you're sinning, that means that danger is going to come upon you.
Yeah, yeah.
If you don't stop.
Now, what of the Judeo-Christian denominations today are warning of the great dangers that we're involved in with the New World Order, with the House of Rothschild, with, the Judgment Day coming? Where's the warning?
Well, it's not only warning about that. What about warning about the simple everyday things, like the slide into...
Yes.
Sexual deviancy.
Right, exactly.
They don't even warn about that. They herald it instead.
Right. Yeah,
and they herald it and positively. They promote it.
Right, right. So it's more iniquity. The reason why the churches aren't giving a warning is because we're warning you against them, right? Christian identity is the only warning. Philosophy coming from the Bible.
Well, right. The mainstream churches have become the enemy.
That's right.
It's the best Christianity the Jews could buy.
That's right. Verse 19. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he turn not from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. In other words, if you don't give the warning, and he doesn't listen, well, then you've done what you could. You can't be expected to do any more than that. Verse 20.
And let me quote James 5:20.
Okay.
Let him know that he which converts the sinner from the error of his way shall save a soul from death and shall hide a multitude of sins.
Yes, very good. So it's very important. Now, again, we're in a situation today where preaching to our brothers and sisters, that they don't like to hear Christian identity preaching, okay?
Well, they don't like to hear anything about
That's
Christianity
right.
at all, almost.
Yeah.
Even the ones that pretend to be Baptists and Episcopalians.
Right.
They really don't want to hear anything about Christianity.
Yeah, right. They don't want to hear Christianity. They want to hear baptism and Episcopalianity, apostianity. They don't want to hear Christianity. And so when these people turn their backs on you, don't worry about it. Develop a thick skin, right? It says
well, right. Well, we have to expect to be rejected. Everybody we talk to, we should expect and anticipate rejection.
Right.
And then when we get somebody that doesn't reject us, we should praise God.
Right, right. Praise Yahweh, yes. But nevertheless, don't give up. Don't stop giving the warning, because these people, the vast majority of them, will wake up. Some of them just before they die, but they will wake up.
Well, I had a philosophy in prison. Never expect anything, and you'll never be disappointed.
Right, right. Okay, verse 20. Again, when a righteous man does turn from his righteousness and commit iniquity, and I lay a stumbling block before him, he shall die, because you have not given him warning. He shall die in his sin, and his righteousness which he has done shall not be remembered, but his blood will I require at your hand. So even the good people, you must keep warning them, and stay awake. Now, this is the parable of the wise and foolish virgins.
Well, right. And I believe that this is, defining the wicked above. The wicked are the righteous who have gone off into sin
right here. Yeah.
They're not the children of the devil. There's no purpose or point in talking to the children of the devil about sin and repentance.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, exactly. We're talking about Israelites here, yeah. I mean, this whole book is addressed to the house of Israel. Verse 21. Nevertheless, if you warn the righteous man that the righteous sin not, and he does not sin, he shall surely live, because he is warned. Also, you have delivered your soul. So anybody who presumes to be a priest, pastor, teacher, etc., you better teach the truth, because Yahweh is going to judge you according to how you have influenced others. Verse 22. And the hand of Yahweh was there upon me, and he said to me, arise, go forth into the plain, and I will there talk with you. Then I arose and went forth into the plain, and behold, the glory of Yahweh stood there as the glory which I saw by the river Kibar, and I fell on my face. Then the Spirit entered into me, and set me upon my feet and spoke with me and said to me, go shut yourself inside the house. Now, here I like to comment on verse 24, because a lot of people believe that the King James Version is an inspired version, and it cannot possibly be. Number one, the translators never claimed to be inspired, but these prophets, these Hebrew prophets, and some of the New Testament prophets constantly are telling us that the Spirit entered into me, and it's really the Spirit speaking. It's not Ezekiel speaking, and the same as in the book of, book of Revelation. It's Yahshua speaking through John. Okay? So it's the Spirit. The original verses of the Hebrew and the Greek are inspired, but the translations are not. Okay? So the King James Version, no one ever claimed that that translation was inspired. So put that thought right out of your head. It's not inspired. There's way too many errors in it. Verse 25. But you, O son of man, behold, they shall put bands upon you, and shall bind you with them, and you shall not go out among them. And I will make your tongue cling to the roof of your mouth, that you shall be dumb, and shall not be to them a reprover, for they are a rebellious house. Now this must be tongue-in-cheek, right? Tongue in the roof of your mouth. Verse 27, but when I speak with you, I will open your mouth, and you shall say to them, thus says Yahweh Elohim, he that hears, let him hear. He that forbears, let him forbear, for they are a rebellious house. Now, go ahead.
Well, I believe the end of this, you know, these last few verses demonstrate that while we should seek the judgments of Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
they are dispensed at his will.
Right.
But we all have an urgent desire to go and tell this people.
Right.
But whether we can or we cannot, or whether we are successful or whether we fail,
mm-hmm.
it's all entirely up to him.
Right. Yeah, and this is very similar to the command that Jesus gave to the apostles when he sent them out to, go to town after town after town. And if one town receives you, then fine, preach the word. If they don't receive you, turn your backs on them, shake the dust off your feet, and go to the next town, right? Okay, we're not to convert people who don't want to listen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. There's only so much we can do. Chapter 4, verse 1, you also, son of man, take you a tile and lay it before you and portray upon it the city, even Jerusalem, and lay siege against it and build a fort against it and cast a mount against it, set the camp also against it and set battering rams against it round about. And isn't this the describing the siege that was to occur in great detail? The very weapons that were used by, who was it now? I can't think of the Babylonian king. Was it Nebuchadnezzar? Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar.
And let me say that, you know, Ezekiel's being told here to literally draw a picture.
Yeah. Right.
I just thought I'd mention that.
Yeah.
It's not a graven image.
Right.
It doesn't violate the command of a graven image.
Right.
But he's being told to draw a picture.
Yes. Okay. Verse 3, moreover, take you to you an iron pan, and set it for a wall of iron between you and the city, and set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, and you shall lay siege against it. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel. Lie you also upon, again, it's the house of Israel. It's not the Jews. Lie you also upon your left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. According to the number of the days that you shall lie upon it, you shall bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon you the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days, so shall you bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. Okay, so what are these 390 days?
I don't know, and I don't have a satisfactory explanation from anything I've read.
Okay. What is it possibly a reference back to the captivity in Egypt?
No, because that didn't last that long.
It did.
The captivity in Egypt only lasted about 6 generations. That was it.
Okay.
It was 430 years.
Right.
Right? From the time of the call of Abraham
mm-hmm.
to the giving of the law at Sinai
okay.
was 430 years.
Okay.
And here we see 390 days and 40 days adds up to 430 years. Now, whether that's significant or not, I don't really see it.
There was 40 years of wandering in the desert, So maybe it's talking, it's adding, subtracting that to get the 390. Okay.
Well, right, but I see no personally. Okay. I don't see it. I thought about it's 390 years.
Mm-hmm.
If it starts at with the Israel kingdom, it doesn't really add up. It doesn't really add up from Ezekiel's time. From the time this happens, it brings us down to about 202 BC.
Right.
I don't see anything big happening in that period.
Okay.
Anything significant that, you know, there's no real change in the state of the children of Israel between Ezekiel's time and 500 AD, never mind 202 BC. Except that they're always on the move. So I really can't make anything of this 390 days. I've tried all day. I've thought about it.
And verse 6 talks about the 40 days. The only thing I can think of is the, you just mentioned it, the 430 years divided up into 390 and 40. And 40 years being the amount of time they spent in the desert.
Well, that's a possibility.
Yeah.
But this is this is how long Ezekiel has to bear this task. Representative of the sin of Israel and the sin of Judah.
Right.
And remember that this Israel was a much greater body than Judah.
Sure.
There were 10 tribes versus
two. Right.
Not 9.5 tribes versus 2.5.
Right.
However you want to add it up.
Right, exactly.
But while we're on the topic of the Exodus, a lot of people think that the Hebrews were enslaved for 400 years. That's simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
It's 400 years from the call of Abraham to the the call of Moses, I believe, and 430 to the giving of the law at Sinai, or however you want to put it. But and that's explicitly stated by Paul.
Yeah.
And if you look at the genealogies coming out of the Exodus, that you'll see that they were only in Egypt for about 6 generations.
Okay. Yeah. It's
a much shorter period than most people perceive. They were in Egypt for about 150 years, 180 years.
Okay.
In there.
Yeah. Or was it that their actual captivity?
Well, the actual captivity period was even shorter. Than
okay.
That. Yeah, that they were enslaved in Egypt. That period's a little shorter.
Yeah. Okay. And that was primarily under the Hittites. Wasn't it the Hittite?
It was under the half. It began under the half. Hittite Pharaoh, Thutmose III.
Oh, okay. He was a half Hittite, half Egyptian.
Yes.
So he was a half breed. Okay.
Well, he would have known not Joseph, right?
Right. Exactly. He didn't know Joseph. Okay. Excellent. Verse 6. And when you have accomplished them, lie again on your right side, and you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have appointed you each day for a year. Therefore, you shall set your face toward the siege of Jerusalem. And your arm shall be uncovered, and you shall prophesy against it. And behold, I will lay bands upon you, and you shall not turn you from one side to the other till you have ended the days of your siege. Okay, so this is a long time to lie on your left side, and another not quite as long to lie on your right side, but it would get very uncomfortable. Verse 9, take you also to you wheat and barley and beans and lentils and millet and fitches, and put them in one vessel, and make you bread thereof, according to the number of the days that you shall lie upon your side. 390 days shall you eat thereof, and your meat which you shall eat shall be by weight, 20 shekels a day. From time to time shall you eat it.
Now, one of the sources I read to try to gain insight on is 390 years, but he said nothing that was constructive about it.
Oh, okay.
Was Adam Clark. Who's very good about a lot of topics.
Yeah.
And he, this 20 shekels is about 10 ounces a day of bread.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed about right. But he had no clue one of 390 days.
Okay. All right. Verse 11, you shall drink also water by measure, the sixth part of a hin. From time to time you shall drink. And you shall eat it as the barley cakes, and you shall bake it with dung. That comes out of a man in there. No, I don't eat that.
Now that's a great reproach.
Right.
They did use dung for fuel.
Uh-huh.
But
right.
Usually it was animal dung.
Right.
And Ezekiel will make that appeal here in a verse or two.
Uh-huh. Okay. And Yahweh said, even thus shall the children of Israel eat their defiled bread among the nations where I will drive them. And that's true, folks. That's really what our people have been doing, and our people are still doing it by race mixing. Verse 14, Then said I, Ah, Yahweh Elohim, behold, my soul has not been polluted, for from my mouth up until now. Even until now have I not eaten of that which dies of itself, or is torn in pieces, neither came there abominable flesh into my mouth. Okay, so he obeyed the food laws.
Right, and one of them would be not to eat
dung. Right.
Well, fuel your food with human dung. Yeah.
Right. Verse 15, then he said to me, Lo, I have given you cow's dung for man's dung, and you shall prepare your bread therewith.
So we can cook on cow poop.
Yeah, right. Verse 16, moreover, it's a barbecue. Moreover, he said to me, Son of man, behold, I will break the staff of bread in Jerusalem, and they shall eat bread by weight and with care, and they shall drink water by measure and with astonishment. Okay. In other words, there will be rationing. Okay.
Well, right. And that's, you know, this 40 years for Judah, it doesn't make any obvious sense whatsoever, because
right.
Jerusalem was actually broke 7 years after this,
mm-hmm.
after this prophecy was
made. Yeah. Okay. Verse 17, that they may want bread and water and be astonished one with another and consume away for their iniquity. And the repeated theme throughout Scripture is that that Yahweh is punishing the Israelites. And they don't seem to understand why, right? He punishes us for our iniquity. How many times does he have to tell us? And yet,
and we see the same scenario today.
That's right.
People wonder why they work all week and have nothing.
That's right.
They wonder why.
Why the country's going to the Mexicans.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And they don't even realize that that's bad, right?
Yeah, right. It's just happening, Bill. There's no explanation. Chapter 5, verse 1. And you, son of man, take you a sharp knife, take you a barber's razor, and cause it to pass upon your head and upon your beard. Then take you balances to weight and divide the hair. You shall burn with fire a third part in the midst of the city when the days of the siege are fulfilled, and you shall take a third part and smite about it with a knife, and a third part you shall scatter in the wind, and I will draw out a sword after them.
And that's representative of what he's going to do with the people.
That's right. That's right.
And that's why only 144,000 were sealed in the Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe they were those who came through this tribulation.
Yes, very good. You shall also take thereof a few in number and bind them in your skirts, then take of them again and cast them into the midst of the fire and burn them in the fire, for thereof shall a fire come forth into all the house of Israel. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, this is Jerusalem. I have set it in the midst of the nations and countries that are round about her. And she has changed my judgments into wickedness more than the nations, and my statutes more than the countries that are round about her. We're worse than the heathen, for they have refused my judgments and my statutes, and they have not walked in them.
Now, this verse right here, these two verses, that this proves our interpretation of the word Jerusalem concerning
mm-hmm.
the new Jerusalem in prophecy,
yes.
Because he says, you know, he's talking about the scattering and killing a third and scattering a third. And he's talking about the house of Israel and says,
yes.
This is Jerusalem. I have set it in the midst of the nations and countries that are around about her.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the children of Israel
are
Jerusalem scattered throughout these nations.
Right.
So when we see the regathered children of Israel, we see Jerusalem.
That's right.
We see the Zion and the Jerusalem of prophecy.
Right. It's a metaphorical
Jerusalem.
Not that city
in Palestine.
Yeah, and those people who want to interpret the word Jerusalem literally in every case, they're simply wrong.
Well, right. In most cases in the prophets, where Jerusalem is talked about as going to be destroyed, that's talking about the city.
That's right.
But where it's talked about in the future, that's talking about his people who are being moved to a new land.
That's right. Verse 7, therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, because you multiplied more than the nations that are round about you and have not walked in my statutes, neither have kept my judgments, neither have done according to the judgments of the nations that are around about you, therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, behold, I, even I, am against you and will execute judgments in the midst of you in the sight of the nations.
Now let me say that verse 7, because you multiplied more than the nations that are round about you. The Septuagint says, because your occasion from the nations round about you. And Brenton added, for sin has been taken. I didn't get the chance to examine the Greek, but the Septuagint reading is very different. Has nothing about the people multiplying.
Right, right.
Now the NAS, which I really do find more reliable than the King James in most instances, in the Masoretic Hebrew.
Okay.
It's not any good in the Greek in the New Testament.
Okay.
But the NAS states, because you have more turmoil than the nations which surround you. But it's just a demonstration that this verse is probably corrupt and poorly understood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that makes sense, because you have more turmoil, because we have consciences that we're constantly struggling with our iniquity. You know, many of us are trying to do right, and yet our neighbor Israelites are all doing wrong, and there's turmoil. There's constant turmoil in a house that should be righteous and is not, whereas the other nations, they're just doing what comes naturally, and they don't feel any problem, right? There's no problem. Verse 8, therefore, thus says Yahweh Elohim, behold, I, even I, am against you, and will execute judgments in the midst of you, in the sight of the nations, and I will do in you that which I have not done, and whereto I will not do any more the like, because of all of your abominations. And to me, what this verse is referring to is the dispersion, the long range dispersion, hearkening back to Leviticus chapter 26, the seven times punishment. That's a one time deal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's what this is talking about, the dispersion of the Israelites from Palestine and the eventual regathering here in America, and, of course, the resettlement in all the European Euro nation states. Okay, verse 10, therefore, the fathers shall eat the sons in the midst of you, and the sons shall eat their fathers, and I will execute judgments in you, and the whole remnant of you will I scatter into all the winds. Wherefore, as I live, says Yahweh Elohim, surely because you have defiled my sanctuary with all your detestable things. He's talking about us, folks. He's not talking about the enemies, the Greeks or the Romans that are coming in and slaughtering pigs on the altar. He's talking about us. My sanctuary with all your detestable things and with all your abominations, therefore will I also diminish you. Neither shall my eye spare, neither will I have any pity. And we're being diminished today, aren't we?
Well, right, and we wonder why we've had intertribal warfare with our own, amongst our own white tribes,
right,
for 2,500 years.
Mm-hmm.
We wonder why we've had that, but the only explanation is that we are the children of Israel.
That's right, because we're not obeying the laws. Okay, very good. Verse 12. A third part of you shall die with the pestilence, and with famine shall they be consumed in the midst of you, and a third part shall fall by the sword round about you, and I will scatter a third part into all the winds, and I will draw out a sword after them. Okay, this sounds like the dispersion being chased west, okay, by the various pursuing tribes, such as the Mongols, the Mohammedans, etc., etc. Verse 13, thus shall my anger be accomplished, and I will cause my fury to rest upon them, and I will be comforted, and they shall know that I, Yahweh, have spoken it in my zeal when I have accomplished my fury in them. Now, I have to pause here, because it's really obvious to me, Bill, that the Judeo-Christian churches do not understand, can't possibly understand what these verses mean. Because they don't know anything about the dispersion of the 10 northern tribes.
Well, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And Jeremiah 30, and this is just one example of many. For I am with thee, says Yahweh, to save thee, though I make a full end of all the nations where I have scattered thee, yet I will not make a full end of thee.
Right.
And so we're promised this punishment, but we're also promised that it won't lead to our ultimate demise.
Right.
There are many statements like that in Jeremiah. And there's another one in Ezekiel chapter 11 here. And there's others in Isaiah. And basically, where are the white Assyrians?
Yeah.
Where are the white Babylonians? Where are the white Persians? And where are the white Medes?
Yeah, they've been dispersed, haven't they?
Well, they're gone. They have no national identity, period.
Right.
And that's, Yahweh said he would make a full end of them. Now there may be some of their descendants amongst us.
Sure.
But they will be in the resurrection. But Yahweh made a full end of those nations.
Mm-hmm.
And that.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, this prophecy all coincides so well with secular history. It's incredible that more people can't examine this and see it. It only proves to me that the word of God is true.
Yeah.
The word of Yahweh is absolutely true.
Yeah, well, the Judeo-Christians cannot relate this to secular history because they don't know the secular history.
Yeah, they're told that all they ever need is the 66 books found in their King James Bible. They never need anything else in their whole life.
Right.
I've heard that statement from Judeo-Christians.
Right, well, because it's inspired, right? So why can't they understand it?
Yeah, it's inspired by somebody that drinks from Monday through Saturday, gets up and gives some little sermon he copied out of Bullinger on Sunday.
Yeah, the street corner theologian, let me have some bourbon and I'll preach, right? Verse 14, moreover, I will make you waste and reproach among the nations that are round about you in the sight of all of that. And this is still happening to us today. We become a reproach. The white race, we're blamed for everything. Whitey owes us. That's what the blacks say.
Well, that's because we allow ourselves to be blamed.
That's right. But, of course, we deserve it, don't we?
We absolutely do. We have no solid ground to stand on.
That's right.
Well, once you have a solid foundation, once you stand on the rock, well then you can't be blamed. You can't. You won't be reproached by the others.
Yeah, yeah. And this is perfectly in line with the Stone Kingdom prophecy, you know, we talked about last week, that will last forever. Even though the people who are the citizens of the kingdom aren't doing too well, we're full of reproach. But at least there is always a remnant that is trying to do their best and trying to obey Yahweh's laws. And verse 15, so it shall be a reproach and a taunt, an instruction and an astonishment to the nations that are round about you, when I shall execute judgments in you in anger and in fury and in furious rebukes, I, Yahweh, have spoken it. So the other nations can see that Yahweh is punishing us, but we can't see it. Verse 16, and of course the Judeo-Christians can't see it. When I shall send upon them the evil arrows of famine, which shall be for their destruction, and which shall send to, I shall send to destroy you, and I will increase the famine upon you and will break your staff of bread. There will be famine, folks. It's coming. Verse 17. So will I send upon you famine and evil beasts, and they shall bereave you, and pestilence and blood shall pass through you, and I will bring the sword upon you. I, Yahweh, have spoken it. Now, these punishments don't go away just because Jesus died on the cross, right? But that's what these churches believe.
Well, you know, we were promised seven times of punishment.
Right.
And when Christ came, we were only through about two of those times.
Right. Right. So
I mean, he came. His sacrifice was about 730 years after
right.
he ceased to be a nation.
Right. And so there were
1,800
times.
Years left.
That's
and,
right.
And after those 1,800 years, we began as I believe. We began as we passed from the captivity and through the 2,500 years, we came into an era of self-government.
Right.
And I believe that precipitates the time of Jacob's trouble, which we're in now.
Right.
And that's the final proof to us that we cannot govern ourselves.
Right.
That Yahweh is our only legitimate king.
Yes.
Well, we had 2,520 years of tyranny. And now we think we're free, and we still can't do it right.
Right.
And we're not free at all.
Yeah. Well, because we're still trying to do it our way, you know, instead of Yahweh's way. And it just doesn't work. But since we started 10 minutes late, let's continue. Let's go through chapter 6 here. And the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, Son of man, set your face toward the mountains of Israel. And the mountains would be the nations and the leaders.
Well, right, because there's nobody in the physical Israel at
right.
this time except Samaritans and Edomites.
Yeah, so right, and this is definitely another metaphorical statement, the mountains of Israel, okay, and prophesy against them and say, you mountains of Israel, hear the word of Yahweh Elohim. Thus says Yahweh Elohim to the mountains and to the hills, to the rivers, to the valleys, And we're not talking literal hills, rivers, and valleys, folks. Behold, I will bring a sword upon you, and I will destroy your high places. And that's those pagan temples that they were creating, right? And your altar shall be desolate, and your images shall be broken, and I will cast down your slain men before your idols. And I will lay the dead carcasses of the children of Israel before their idols, and I will scatter your bones round about your altars. And all your dwelling places, the city shall be laid waste, and the high places shall be desolate, that your altars may be laid waste and made desolate, and your idols may be broken and cease, and your images may be cut down, and your works may be abolished. So it's very obvious that Yahweh doesn't care for our pagan, the pagan rituals that we have adopted, right?
And of course, right, and look at the Catholic Church.
Yeah. And it's not just these old-fashioned pagan rituals. We're engaging in pagan rituals today, although we just don't see it as such.
Right.
Okay? And this soccer tournament. You know, it's like people kill each other to get tickets, right? And if your team loses, there's a war.
Well, that's
crazy.
Idolatry.
It's idolatry.
That's worshiping the creation. There's no doubt.
Yes.
I believe that all of professional sports is
yeah, the real fanatics are really engaging in idolatry. There's no doubt. Yes. Verse 7. And the slain shall fall in the midst of you, and you shall know that I am Yahweh. Yet will I leave a remnant, that you may have some that shall escape the sword among the nations, when you shall be scattered through the countries. And they that escape of you shall remember me among the nations, where they shall be carried captives, because I am broken with their whorish heart, which has departed from me, and with their eyes, which go whoring after their idols, and they shall loathe themselves for the evils which they have committed and all their abominations. And I could say, Bill, that only those of us in Christian identity, and perhaps some in British Israel, who are, confronting our sinfulness. The other churches aren't confronting sinfulness. They're saying everything is just fine. The antinomians don't even believe there's such a thing as sin.
Well, they want to negotiate away what sin is.
Mm-hmm.
That they want to we're modern now, so we could sin a little. Well,
yeah.
We could start allowing this and that and the other.
Right.
Thing.
Yeah.
But we can start marrying men to men.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay now.
Yes. Yeah. And all the other abominations that the churches have let in. Verse 10.
I don't know how they sleep at night.
Yeah, me too. It's really strange because you read the Bible and all of this stuff is forbidden and they're doing it. Verse 10.
And they're doing it and they're rationalizing how it's legitimate now.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
It's like Packard said 2,000 years ago that they engage in deviation and call it modern.
Yeah.
He said that 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, it's coming from the pulpits, folks. It's not coming from the heathen. It's coming from our own pulpits. Verse 10. And they shall know that I am Yahweh, and that I have not said in vain that I would do this evil to them. Thus says Yahweh Elohim, smite with your hand and stamp with your foot and say, alas for all the evil abominations of the house of Israel, for they shall fall by the sword, by the famine, and by the pestilence. He that is far off shall die of the pestilence, and he that is near shall fall by the sword. And he that remains and is besieged will die by the famine. Thus will I accomplish my fury upon them. The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Then shall you know that I am Yahweh, when their slain men shall be among their idols round about their altars, upon every high hill, in all the tops of the mountains, under every green tree, and every thick oak, the place where they did offer sweet savor to all their idols. And I could say, Bill, a lot of these churches allow Wiccans.
Well, I thought this was describing Odin.
Right, okay.
That's who it's describing. The Odinists don't realize it, but they are practicing Neo-Canaanitism.
That's right.
That should be the proper name of their religion.
That's right.
It's Neo-Canaanitism.
That's right.
Exactly what it is.
Very good, very good. Verse 14, so will I stretch out my hand upon them and make the land desolate, yea, more desolate than the wilderness towards Diblath in all their habitations, and they shall know that I am Yahweh. Okay, so folks, yeah.
Let me just say that, this is also, it's a punishment process,
mm-hmm.
but it's also, as Yahweh promised, a cleansing process.
Right.
That he would, he would put us through these nations that we were dispersed to like a sieve. And the good people, yeah, you know, most of the wicked people
good
among
people
us, I believe,
the people,
well, yeah, right, because there was a lot of bad blood in Israel,
right.
And that had to be destroyed.
That's right.
That had to be weeded out so that we would be separated from our Canaanitism, and a people came out the other end that would accept Christianity so many thousands of years, you know, 1,700
right.
years later
yes.
in some cases.
Yes, yes. So this has been a 2,500-year trial by fire, folks, and it ain't over yet. It ain't over yet because only the remnant gets through the fire, folks. Only the remnant is tried and purified like fine silver and fine gold. So we have to decide whether we want to be part of the fine silver and fine gold or we want to be part of the weeds, the tares, the goats, the symbolism. The symbol, yeah, no weeds get into the kingdom. Thank you, Commander. The weeds don't get in. And a lot of those weeds are Israelites because they're practicing Canaanitism, neo-Canaanitism. Okay, you have to come up with a better word. It's not such a tongue twister.
Well, right. How about neo-Cainism?
Cain, right, there you go. Neo-Cain. You're a neocon.
Yeah, neo-Cain.
Right. Okay. All right, folks. I think we got a really good start here on the book of Ezekiel. The prophecies. In the book of Ezekiel are going to get very, very specific, and they can only have been fulfilled in the true Israelites of the world, folks, that is the Anglo-Saxon, Celtic, and Caucasian people. None of this stuff applies to the Jews unless we're talking about Gog and Magog and the evil Canaanites. We will recognize the Jews and those people in the book of Ezekiel, okay? So, thank you very much for listening tonight. Thank you, Bill, for helping me go through these. And we'll resume with Chapter 7 next week, okay?
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh. And for those people still listening, my guest tomorrow is going to be Neil Koch. He's going to be...
You mean Sunday.
Oh, Sunday, sorry. And tomorrow you're going to be on by yourself.
No, tomorrow I'll be here with Clifton. And
oh,
we'll
Clifton.
Be talking about... geography or genealogy.
Okay.
And how people in the Old Testament were referred to by geography.
Right.
Every time it says Uriah the Hittite or so-and-so the Ammonite.
Ruth the Moabite.
Very often, Ruth the Moabite, they
yes.
were only geographical
right.
names. They,
okay.
Geographical distinctions. They were not genealogical.
Okay. So you're going to clarify that. And then on Sunday, my guest will be Neil Koch, who is a boar. Talking about the prophecies of Van Rensburg, who very, very clearly foresaw the day that Nelson Mandela would rule Africa and there would be a great slaughter of the white race in southern Africa. And that's going to be the show for Sunday. So please tune in tomorrow night for Bill and Clifton and for my show on Sunday with Neil Koch. Thank you for listening. Yahweh bless everybody.
Praise Yahweh.
Praise Yahweh.